You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Matthew Leach, talking National League East with MLB.com's NL East beat reporters. We'll be talking about Julio Teheran and Alex Wood and the Braves rotation. We'll be talking about the Marlins clubhouse and manager and how all that's going as they try and get on the right track. We're talking about the amazing Mets who are living up to that name this year and how they are filling a whole bunch of injury holes and taking care of some issues. We're talking about the Washington Nationals also doing some injury updates, but also taking a look at that starting rotation, some good, some not so good. And we're talking about the Philadelphia Phillies and how they fix an offense that needs to be better than it's been so far. Mark, it's going pretty well for the Braves right now, but I was looking and looking at what's going on there, and I'm struck that while the rotation has been decent, it's not getting a lot of innings. Is that something they're just going to have to live with, or is that something that either just because it happens or from some kind of fix is going to get better as this year goes on?
Well, I think they are going to get more innings than they had last night. Eric Stoltz went six innings. That was just the fifth time in a span of 14 games that the Braves have had a pitcher or starting pitcher go as last as long as six innings. And that obviously would become a problem as the year goes on because it's going to put even more it's going to tax an inexperienced bullpen that you know, did exceed the expectations during the first week of the season. And as this you know, this past week's gone on when they've struggled, the bullpen has been an issue. You've seen some of the younger kids who flourished during the early part of the season with Brandon Kniff. He hasn't given up a lot of runs, but you're starting to see some command problems. Cody Martin gave up a home run last night. He's still only given up two runs over 10 innings. Really, the primary concern with the bullpen right now is Jim Johnson. The struggles that he's had over the last three games, he's retired just six of the past 18 batters he's faced. Yeah, he might have, you know, maybe there was, you know, some bad luck, however you want to call it, you know, last night. But at the same time, you know, here's a veteran pitcher that's got to be able to, you know, perform better than he has, you know, especially with the guys that are sitting behind him in that bullpen. You need Jason Grilli, Luis Avalon, and Jim Johnson to shine in their roles. And right now, Johnson has provided us, you know, somewhat of concern.
Yeah, I mean, that can't be a big surprise, right? I realize he was pretty good a few years ago, but he was kind of a lottery ticket, right? I mean, it seems like they were expecting a lot rather than hoping from a guy where maybe the wiser course of action was to hope.
Yeah, I mean, let's look at it. You know, they signed him for $1.5 million. You're buying low on this guy. The expectation when they signed him in December was, hey, you know, hey, he's going to pitch in the sixth and seventh innings. We'll work his way towards the eighth inning role. Obviously, he pitches effectively in spring training. They build a little more confidence in him. Then Craig Kimbrell gets traded the day before the season starts. All of a sudden, Jim Johnson, your eighth inning guy slash, you know, part-time closer those days that Jason really can't go. And you know, yes, you do hope that you know, he can get back to where he was during his days in Baltimore, but even those days, you know, when he was notching 50 saves a season, he wasn't done in Kimbrel-like fashion. It wasn't necessarily dominant. His sinker still has a, you know, it's still moving pretty well. But at the same time, you know, guys are putting the ball in play here the last three appearances. He's missing the strike zone. Just the execution of his pitches has not been sharp, and he's paid the price. So, yeah, as you said, you can't be completely shocked. You bought low. It was a gamble. And right now you have to hope that this ends up just being a small glitch in the season for him. You know, just a rough spot that he's bound to encounter. But you have to wonder if you know, will he, you know, make a quick turnaround, or will the season continue to go much like last year's did for him?
I want to go back to the rotation a little bit. There's some things to like, but they're not striking anybody out, and this has the potential to be a good defensive team in some spots. Certainly, they've got, you know, probably the best shortstop in the game. But, you know, that's something that in this era, and if you don't have gold glovers all over the infield, has potential to bite you. I mean, again, I guess it's not really the kind of thing you can do something to fix, but is there anything that stands out with some of these guys? Some of these guys should be strikeout guys. I mean, Tehran should probably be striking out more guys than he is. Shelby Miller has that ability. Do you see that as something that – it's got to be one of two things. Either it's going to get better or it's going to come home to roost. So which do you think it is, I guess, is the question.
Yeah, I mean, I think as you get on it there with Tehran and Shelby Miller, the one guy that I'm interested to see where he goes from here is Alex Wood, a very talented guy who has shown the ability to strike out guys in the past. His velocity was down a little bit in his first two outings. He got back up closer to normal there his last time out in Toronto, but he hasn't had that strikeout pitch working yet. And like you said, there have been a lot of balls put in play. Fortunately, the Braves have been a strong defensive team so far this year. Just three errors, two of those coming the last two nights with two different second basemen, Phil Gosselin and Jace Peterson there. Fielding grounders, obviously the Gosselin error ended up being looming large. But, yeah, I think that at the end of the day, and this is this era, that you do need to see some better strikeout numbers, because at the end of the day, you know, obviously the more balls put in play, the odds are increased that something is going to end up happening. And that's actually the attack that the Braves are trying to have from an offensive perspective. They're saying, hey, look, if we put the ball in play more frequently than we did last year, then despite the fact we don't have a lot of power in this lineup, we're going to, you know, the offense is going to still be effective. So, I think the one guy that I want to look at as time goes on here is Alex Wood. Where does he go from here? You know, does the velocity stay right there? You know, one thing you have to remember is he missed his last start of the year last year, which was probably just a minor, some forearm stiffness there. But at the same time, had they been in contention, maybe he had made that start. Maybe we would have never known about it. But the fact that we do know about it and the velo is down slightly, that is something to watch here the next couple weeks.
Now I want to talk a little franchise four, and I think maybe the Braves are one of the ones that kind of are drawing some more attention, just kind of broadly. I mean, there's this interesting mix of some all-time Hall of Famers and some people that a lot of people who use the internet grew up watching. So we got the first round of votes yesterday, and it's Hank Aaron, Chipper Jones, Greg Maddux, and Warren Spahn. Now, that's fairly hard to argue with any of those until you look at the guys who were left out, include Glavin, Eddie Matthews, Dale Murphy, and John Smoltz. If it were up to you, would you knock any of those four guys out for any of the four guys who aren't currently in there?
You know, when I look at this, I look at the value that they brought to the franchise as a whole. And obviously Aaron is going to be on everyone's ballot, and rightfully so. The one guy I would put in there definitely from the four that are left out is Glavin, just because of the impact that he had, not only on the mound, just being there from the beginning of the run. Now Smoltz was there throughout the entire run of division, 14 straight division titles. But Glavin seemed to have even a greater impact, not only within the clubhouse, on the mound. So I would have him in there. I do think that I would go ahead and put Spahn in there, and probably the tough one is to choose between Chipper Jones and Eddie Matthews, and it does not surprise me, you know, that the Chipper's getting the votes, because the people who are voting, you know, the majority of them did not see Eddie Matthews play. But if you put the numbers up, you know, stack them up against each other, I think you've got to go with Eddie Matthews there.
Yeah, he's got to be on the really short list of the best players that people just have no idea how good they are. And to some extent, I'd probably put Joe Morgan on that list, a different kind of player. But any thought as to why that is? I mean, he didn't really play in Atlanta except for, you know, half a season. But
right.
Probably the least known 500 home run guy.
Yeah, you're right. You know, I don't know, is that because he spent you know, majority of his career in Milwaukee, you know, and I've even heard people say that, you know, for a period that during Hank's career, you know, when he was, you know, working his way through, you know, towards, you know, Babe Ruth's record, you know, for a long stretch there, that he was not as respected as maybe he would have been had he been in a bigger market. Maybe that has something to do with Eddie Matthews, you know, as well, that most of his glory days were spent there. And, you know, I think he like you said, he had, you know, just the half season there in Atlanta, people have forgotten about him. Chipper Jones comes along, and then people think of him as being the greatest third baseman in franchise history. But, you know, I don't even think he really deserves that moniker when you talk to people about what Eddie Matthews did throughout his career. And just look and stack up the numbers. I don't know. I don't know if it's going to help him here in the franchise four voting. But I, you know, those who did have a chance to watch both of them, I don't think they're going to argue against Eddie Matthews of having had the better career.
Bill, the injury report keeps looking better. Two of the three really essential lineup guys are back, and the third one is close. So first of all, what is the story with Anthony Rendon? What's his timetable? How close is he to being back?
Well, Anthony Rendon is close to being ready. He should start his rehab assignment hopefully on Friday if things go well in his minor league games. So far, you know, so good. The knee is much better. There's no more pain. The leg gets stiff once in a while, but I'm telling you, he's close to being ready. And when he gets back to the team, he will play third base.
Will they need to give him maintenance days, at least in the beginning? Is he a guy that they may sort of handle gently in the first few weeks and maybe even beyond that for a guy who just has a significant injury history?
You know what? Knowing Matt Williams, there's no question in my mind, Matthew, he is going to get some rest. There's no question. And we're going to see a lot of Escobar at third base when Anthony Rendon is not playing. So, yes, he's going to get some time off occasionally. And knowing Matt Williams the way I do, we're going to see, you know, at least Anthony Rendon at least get one day off a week.
How are they going to handle that? Because I thought it was an interesting question. I mean, Rendon has shown himself to be so effective at third. I didn't really think there was that much question there, but does second base become any kind of a mixture when Rendon comes back? Do you see some other guys mix in there, or have Espinoza and Uglin not really shown enough to push Escobar, and Escobar just becomes a second baseman now?
Well, Escobar has done a great job, and Espinoza and Uglin have not shown enough hitting-wise. Defensively, they've been okay. But when everyone is healthy, we're going to see Escobar back at second. And we could see Rendon back at second as well, because Matt Williams said that when Rendon is fully healthy, he could play both positions.
What would be the reason for doing that? I mean, other than just sort of in a pinch where you had to use versatility, is there an argument for moving Rendon to second? Because this seems to be something that has been discussed a lot in among the Nationals media recently. What would be the reasoning for that? What would be the impetus to think about Rendon back at second and doing something different at third?
Well, the only thing I can think of is, you know, is maybe to avoid less work at second. You know, you get less work at second, I think. And I really don't know the answer to that, but they really think that he can play both positions. And if he can do that, that remains to be seen.
Sure. As for the most recent guy to come back, again, I know it's early. I know we're it's kind of unfair to judge a guy, but in these first couple of games back, how has Denard Span looked to you?
Defensively, the guy looks great. I mean, obviously, offensively, you know, he's going to take some time because he's been out a long time. Even in his rehab starts, it wasn't that much. So I'm telling you, he'll be back in no time, and I expect him to be back to being what he used to be in a week or two.
I kind of feel like the old Chris Farley. Remember, that was awesome. I don't exactly know how to ask this about Max Scherzer other than to say, has he been just basically what you've expected? I mean, this guy's numbers and performance early have been spectacular.
He's more than I think what everyone expected. He's really, he hasn't had much run support per se, but I'm just telling you, he's been unhittable. And I can understand why he's the number one starter on this team. And he can really get people out, and he's playing his hometown team today, the St. Louis Cardinals. He's from St. Louis, and I'm expecting him to have another good game.
On the flip side of that, a couple of starters who aren't off to great overall starts. Gio Gonzalez, I sort of wonder, is this just kind of what he is at this point, a guy with great stuff, a guy with an ability to be outstanding, but a guy who's going to walk enough batters that sometimes he's just not – this is, I guess that's kind of the question. Is this kind of what he is at this point, or do you think that he still has that capacity to get back to being an all-star type starter?
Matthew, this is the way he was in Oakland. When he was in Oakland, he was walking a lot of batters. It's frustrating to watch sometimes, but you got to realize, though, he was this way in Oakland, even when he was good there. And I think this is the way he is. In 2012, he was a totally different player. I mean, he was an all-star. Hardly didn't walk any batters, but he's back to what he was in Oakland. And, you know, sometimes it can be frustrating, but how he gets that fixed, I guess, is a mechanical issue, but he's going to have to get it fixed sooner or later because it's up and down with him so far.
Yeah, I mean, it's just fascinating. He has those first two games where he was decent, and then the St. Louis game, I'm watching, and I'm sure you had a similar experience. I watch it, and every inning I get out, I can't believe there's still no runs on the board. I mean, to some extent, that's a tribute to a guy with the stuff to get out of jams, but
right.
That's also a worrisome game when you see a guy give up 12 base runners in six innings.
Matthew, I think you were being nice. I mean, he did not look good at all, in my opinion, and it's just that he just got out of those jams. So how he gets out of those jams is beyond me. You know, to me, Gio has to do the little things to get things right. You know, covering first base, sometimes he doesn't do that. He walks too many hitters. I think it's the little things that he has to fix more than stuff. It's the little things.
And then the other guy that I look at in that rotation, Jordan Zimmermann is not having a great year. The thing that stands out to me, I look, his velocity's down a good bit. He was steadily high 93 for three straight years, 93.8, 93.9, 93.7.
Right.
This year it's 92.1. Now, again, we can get into trouble talking velocity in April. Some guys build it over the course of a year, but when that combines with a dip in overall effectiveness, I think it's natural to at least worry a little bit. Two questions, really. What are you seeing with your own eyes with Jordan Zimmermann, and what are people around the organization saying about him at this point?
Well, that was brought up the other day. Matt Williams, and especially in Boston when he got hit hard, what happened there was that he had a tough time gripping the ball, according to Matt Williams. So, I mean, I'm going to take Matt Williams at his word that this is a guy who's having problems gripping the ball. And, all right, I'll take that. But, I mean, I have to take a wait-and-see approach before I say his velocity's down. Because, you know, right now, Matthew, even though he's off to a slow start, outside of Scherzer, I think he's their best pitcher. And I'm going to have to wait and see before I say anything else.
It's been a weird year for Ian Desmond, who is hitting the ball really well and seems to maybe be stabilizing a little bit defensively, but still a ton of errors. When you look at him, what do you see going on with Desmond?
Well, he goes through this every eight, and I have to think it's a mental thing with him. I mean, I don't think it's a physical thing. And, you know, let me tell you, man, this guy feels really bad about what happened. I mean, especially what happened this past Saturday. And I think he'll, you know, we're close to the end of the month. I think the errors will stop. I think he'll go back to being the Ian Desmond we used to seeing. And believe me when I tell you, he feels bad when he makes those errors. And, you know, the thing is, though, he's a class act when it comes to things going wrong. He's always there talking to us, and he has no excuses. It's just a mental thing with him. And how he fixed that, no one really knows. I mean, is he going to see a doctor? No. But he just, I think what helps him is that Matt Williams and Mike Rizzo, they go to him and say, hey, you're doing a great job, and keep doing the good work. And that's how he gets over it. I mean, I can remember one time, Matthew, everyone was talking about trading Ian Desmond a few years back. And it was bothering Ian Desmond. And then David Johnson said, hey, you're my shortstop. You're not playing the outfield. You're not doing any of these things. And to Ian Desmond, it felt like someone gave him a 5-year contract. So, I mean, I think it's a mental thing with him. As long as the team and his teammates say, hey, you're our guy, we love you, he's going to be okay.
I'm looking at his offensive numbers, and it's not an enormous shift. And again, as with everything, it's April. But I do wonder a little bit. It's kind of interesting. His average is up. His strikeouts are down a little bit. His offensive profile looks a little more like the guy from 2012 who pushed 300 and struck out 113 times instead of 180. Is that the result of a conscious effort? Is he really trying to be a little more of a high average, put the ball in play guy a little more?
Yes, there's no question about it, because when spring training started, even the end of last year, he was very upset by all the strikeouts he had. He couldn't believe how many times he struck out last year. He was shocked. So, yes, that is a conscious effort to cut down on the strikeouts. And, you know, the guy drove in 90 runs last year still. But it was alarming to him that he struck out so many times. So, yes, he realizes what's at stake here, and he wants to do better.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about the numbers is that, you know, in 12 and even in 13, you know, the home runs basically stayed the same over those years. As the average dipped, the doubles dipped too, and he went from a guy who could beat you a lot of ways offensively to a guy who basically hit home runs. And it seems like there's a lot of lot to be gained from him, from not only not striking out, but singles, doubles, being that guy who can beat you sort of a variety of different ways.
Right, right. I mean, he can really beat you in a lot of ways. And, you know, the thing I like about Ian Desmond is that he'll go all out no matter how wrong things go. And, you know, in a lot of ways, he's really the captain of this team outside of Jason Wirtz. I mean, he really does a lot of things on the field that people don't see. And he's one of the leaders for sure.
Joe, the story of the week by far started emerging on Sunday. And that is the question of whether there is any pressure. Well, there's obviously pressure. Whether there's anything to this idea that Mike Redmond's job might be in some jeopardy if things don't turn around soon. You've reported some on this. It seems to be different people hear different things. As we sit here now, what's your understanding on where this stands?
Yeah, it's probably one of the more bizarre and unfortunate ways to start a season, because, you know, it's almost like a crisis was created within. You know, they obviously weren't playing well, and everything kind of went way out of control in New York. And now, whether it is or isn't, and there still hasn't been definitive clarity on that Mike Redmond's job could be in jeopardy. You know, you just kind of read with body language and how they respond internally. And, you know, clearly there's an urgency to get this thing turned around. Now, whether or not how quickly or whether or not the manager is at fault is something that's being sorted out. You know, I started hearing, you know, the whole Wally Backman thing. I don't think there was really any legs ever to that, but that kind of took on a life of its own. And, you know, then there's all sorts of reports, and you can always have people pointing fingers or pointing in a direction. But I'm not even sure who's making the call. I mean, you know, whether it's, you know, I spoke with Jeffrey several times in New York, and there was no panic. And so all of a sudden, within that after Saturday's game to Sunday, something, you know, dramatically wrong happened. I'm still not sure exactly what that is.
So obviously, with any organization, it to some extent it goes without saying that if the owner doesn't want a transaction, a major decision to happen, it doesn't happen. The owner is where it stops. But it seems to me that with the Marlins, that is particularly pronounced. That Jeffrey Loria is somebody. If he's happy with how the manager's doing, the manager stays. And if he's not, then the manager goes. And so, I guess what I'm wondering is. What's your impression of what the owner thinks of all this? I mean, a lot of times you say, what's the GM think? What's the GM's mind? And I don't mean to take the legs out from under the GM at all. Clearly, this is an organization with a lot of voices. But Jeffrey Loria seems a particularly prominent voice in the baseball department as these things go. So what's your impression of where things stand in his mind, both as far as a club's performance and as far as a manager's status?
Yeah, I mean, these are the questions that you know, might be only known in those kind of private meetings. You know, Mike Hill and Dan Jennings, as the top baseball executives, have say. The thing about this crisis, Matthew, is they broke spring training on a high. They played very well. Their last Grapefruit League game, they put eight up on Max Scherzer in two innings. You know, they came into the season with momentum. So there was no inkling that, you know, oh, things weren't run right, this wasn't a motivated team. You know, obviously you didn't want to get off to a 1-5 homestand. They win two, then they followed up, win 2-3 in Atlanta, lose a couple in New York, and then all of a sudden it's like everything is just falling apart. That's why, yes, obviously disappointment from a hands-on owner. But, you know, people have been telling me all throughout, even New York up until Saturday before that game, you know, no panic. So something had to have changed if everything is true, that, you know, Mike Redmond's job was in jeopardy, you know, 24 to 48 hours later. So who knows how much is just said in heat of moment stuff that, you know, no one puts so much stock in. But when a story like this is out there and you're on a hot seat, whether you are or not, it's all over MLB Network. It's all over, you know, social media. It's all over everywhere. It's addressed by our company. Because now it is a story, whether it intended to be or not. And, you know, I'm kind of reading the body language of Red's comments and how he's reacting, and clearly there's tension there. I found it interesting last night, D. Gordon had a big night post-game, mentioned credits Mike Redmond and staff for his fast start. I think you're going to start seeing people in the uniform kind of rallying around the manager, but only wins are going to kind of cure it. But I think if they, you know, kind of get something rolling, maybe this will all subside and die down, and the team will be what they think they can be.
One thing you mentioned just a little bit ago was Giancarlo Stanton's comments about how things are going in the clubhouse. And it's an interesting mix with some young guys and a few veterans and a young veteran face of the franchise in Stanton. And so with the acknowledgement that there's only so much even a beat reporter can really know about what goes on behind closed doors, I think we all need to remind, you know, it's one of the things I always had to remind myself, that you're still not finally there, but as somebody who's closer than most of us, what is your read on just kind of how that's all working in this club that is young but has high expectations and isn't meeting them early? How is that playing in there?
Yeah, it is very interesting. The front office had no problem with Stanton's comments when he mentioned that the team kind of lacked fire and they kind of were playing in spurts, not playing nine-inning games. And they looked at it as, this is Giancarlo's team. He could say whatever he wants. And I didn't take it when Giancarlo said that he was completely pointing that at Red, but obviously the manager, you know, sets the tempo. You have a young superstar here who, you know, basically he came up at age 20. And, you know, he was on the team with Hanley Ramirez, and, you know, there were times where people thought he should speak up, but he was, you know, 20, 21, and didn't find that it was his place. The contract, the stature, who he is, the type of player he is, they, you know, he's not a real outspoken guy by nature, but he's the type of guy in this team that if he has something to say, we'll say it. Now, I don't think that team meeting went as well as some people thought. It was a players-only meeting, I should say, because I think that, you know, there was some criticism of Stanton saying, well, you know, who are you to say stuff? You hadn't been that fast to start either. But, you know, players have to air out, you know, what's going on and come together and get on the same page, whether that's in, you know, player-only meetings or that's a guy speaking up. You know, it's a new role for Stanton, but, you know, this guy is the face of this franchise. And I anticipate you'll see more of that, and it is a little bit different role for him.
Let's actually go out onto the field here. This team is slugging .348 as a team, and that's a team that has Giancarlo Stanton. That obviously has to get somewhat better, but to what extent is it a concern? I know that they didn't intend to be a team that only relied on the home run, but you got to hit for some power to score runs. To what extent is there concern about the lack of power that this team has displayed so far?
I just think it's, you know, it's there. I mean, you got Michael Morse is certainly capable of power. Marcell Ozuna hasn't gone deep yet. He's you know, he's a guy that got off to a really slow start, but is starting to get better at bat. I just think they think a lot of it's just really small sample size that, you know, Stanton's still getting his legs under him and, you know, getting acquainted to that, that face guard, which he wears right now against righties and not so much against lefties, that they're going to have a balanced lineup. I think they feel that. I also think this is a, you know, when you start pressing and, you know, the weakness right now is the starting pitching's consistency and, you know, getting those innings with Henderson Alvarez out, that there might be some on the offense to think, hey, you know, we got to do a little bit more. But, you know, this is also a team that's faced everyone's best right now. These first 13, 14 games, they've had Harvey, DeGrom, Teron, Chris Archer, you know, this big win to beat Cole Hamels, didn't even, you know, score the base with a winning run on a ball. You know, finding a way, it's, you know, they're getting these everyone's best right now, and their bats are, you know, still trying to figure that out. So I think that they feel that this team and this lineup is going to score runs. Clearly you need some power, obviously. And I think they feel it's just a matter of just play and let it play itself out.
And now I want to talk a little franchise four with you. The Marlins voting is fascinating and honestly surprising to me. Jeff Conine we knew would be in there. Giancarlo Stanton we knew would be in there. Mike Lowell, not a hard call. Gary Sheffield is the fourth guy, which means that on the outs are Josh Beckett, Luis Castillo, Levon Hernandez, and Charles Johnson. If it were up to you, would any of those four guys be in the top four? And if so, whom would you bump out?
Yeah, it is interesting because, you know, Beckett being the hero he was in three, now these guys, you know, some of these guys had 4 years, you know, total in the organization. It's not a ton of history. You have a lot of fan favorites. Jeff Conine, you know, is immensely popular. He's from day one type of guy and, you know, still works in the organization. So, you know, I think you have a lot of sentiment, you know, over even the absolute performances on the field and longevity. Conine part of two World Series teams, and he got brought in right before September 1st in 03 after Lowell got hurt. You know, to me, Luis Castillo is, you know, he didn't have the power, but in terms of games played, hits, there's so much that he's right at the top, and, you know, you would think he would be someone there. You know, Sheffield's tenure, you know, I really, really strong those first 4 or 5 years of the franchise. But, you know, Marlin fans, they have a lot of their personal favorites, and they tend to vote with their heart. But Beckett would be a guy, because I think what Beckett did in 03 and for that team to win, it really kind of helped save the franchise, in my opinion, because that 03 team, you know, helped get the ballpark built. You know, it helped take away any type of talk of relocation or, you know, starting to figure things out. You know, winning in 03, it took years later before they actually moved into Marlins Park, but it showed that 97 wasn't just a fluke year, that, you know, baseball can win in South Florida and the Marlins can be viable. So I kind of look at things a little bit differently with Beckett and historically what it meant to this franchise.
And you cover the darlings of baseball right now. One of the things that I have often thought about Citi Field is it's really a terrific ballpark, and I can't wait to see it really rock. And we've seen it some with Matt Harvey. We saw it at the All-Star game. But with how the kind of facility, the kind of atmosphere Shea could have, and with what a beautiful ballpark Citi Field is, I think a lot of people have really waited to have that place be electric. And I realize it's only April, but just if you even know Met fans, you know there is excitement about this club. What's the vibe right now about this team that has won 10 in a row and is 12-3?
I mean, what could the vibe be? You get any team in baseball that wins 10 games in a row, it's going to be a lot of positivity. You know, it seems like they could never lose and so on and so forth. Yeah, you know, this is a fun place to watch baseball games. You hear players saying that you see it from the fans. And granted, you know, we're in April. It's still a little cold out. School's in session. They haven't had many of those 40,000-plus crowds yet, but, you know, if they keep playing like this, get into the summer, all of a sudden we can start seeing things here like we haven't seen really since the first year of Citi Field and beyond that, since 07, 08, some of those last years at Shea Stadium when the Mets were really good and they were drawing crazy crowds all the time. It makes a huge difference for the energy level of the players, people in the clubhouse. It's fun for these guys to play when there's 40,000 plus people in the stands, when it's loud, when it's clear that everyone's engaged with what's going on. And, you know, unfortunately, that really hasn't happened here a lot in the past. So it's just another byproduct of winning baseball. You know, people say that winning heals everything, and it's kind of a cliche, but it does. It covers up a lot of things that might not be going your way. If you win, you know, it really takes care of a lot of other little problems that pop up when you don't.
And you kind of touched on what I'm about to ask, which is that, you know, this is a cool story no matter what. I mean, a lot of people have waited for several years for the Mets to be back and really in play, but they're doing without David Wright. They're now doing without Travis d'Arnaud. They're doing without Henry Mejia. I mean, this team has taken a ton of hits, and they are winning. So at the risk of asking a dumb and obvious question, how are they doing it?
Well, the counter-argument, of course, is that it's not sustainable. And in a sense, it's not. No one can sustain, you know, winning 10 games in a row and just never losing. The best teams in baseball can't do that. But, you know, how are they doing it? It's not entirely smoke and mirrors. You know, a lot of the things that we talked about at the beginning of the season in spring training that were going to be so critical for this club have happened. You know, Travis d'Arnaud, he's hurt now, but before he was hurt, he was hitting a lot. We're seeing Curtis Granderson. You know, at first, he wasn't hitting to start the year, but he was drawing a ton of walks. He was getting on base, and he's starting to hit a little bit now. The pitching has been not as good as advertised, but better than advertised, particularly the starting pitching. They've gotten contributions out of the bullpen. The lefty reliever issue, while Jerry Blevins is hurt now, that hasn't been a problem. They've found guys, you know, being Blevins, Alex Torres, Sean Gilmartin, who have come through for this team. So just so many of the things. Wilmer Flores is another story, a guy who's really starting to hit now and whose defense after a rough first week has gotten a lot better. Just all these little things where it's saying, well, if X, Y, and Z go right, the Mets can contend. Well, X, Y, and Z have gone right, and so has A, B, C, D, and so on and so forth. And while they've had some major injuries, the fact that everything around them, you know, has sort of gone according to plan has covered a lot of that up.
Talk a little about some of those injury situations. How are they going to handle the catching duties while they're doing without d'Arnaud? Is that just going to be Kevin Plawecki's job, or as somebody who used to live in Greenpoint, Plawecki? I feel myself inclined to say. How are they going to handle the catching duties?
It's going to be Plawecki, unless he proves that he certainly can't handle it, which he's done the opposite so far. He's had a nice little start to his big league career, but they're going to give him every chance to succeed there. And the hope is that d'Arnaud will be maybe 4 or 5 weeks and he'll be back. And, you know, maybe they have a nice little problem on their hands. Maybe it's just as easy as d'Arnaud sliding right back in and Plawecki going back down to AAA. But you know, they like Plawecki a lot. And this is a nice little showcase for him, A, to prove that he's big league ready, that he doesn't deserve to go back down, you know, when d'Arnaud comes back. But B, if he really takes this opportunity and runs with it, he could turn into a nice little trade chip for the Mets, you know, come the trade deadline when they might be looking to add, when they might be in contention at or near the top of the NL East with what they're doing now. If they have something they want to add at that time, he could be the guy that could really fetch them a nice prospect, a young, controllable catching prospect who's under team control for 6 seasons, he could really fetch them a nice piece.
And then the other thing that has really been hit hard is the bullpen. They continue losing guys one way or another. Is that beginning to be a worry just for sheer number of effective bodies, or is there enough optimism about guys coming back that they figure they can make it work until they start getting guys back again?
Well, it's definitely a concern because they've dipped into their depths to a big extent already so far. And what they have going for them is that, you know, the guys who have been here, who have been forced into duty, have performed well. So they really haven't missed the Henry Mejias of the world and some of the other guys. But, yeah, it's always a concern. They went into this season thinking the bullpen was going to be a real strength, but they lost a lot of depth pretty quickly with the guys they lost due to injury, with Mejia due to suspension, and so on and so forth. But it's another of those things, like we talked about at first. You know, until something actually starts going wrong, they seem to be in pretty good shape. They haven't really missed these guys. They went the first week plus of the season with an eight-man bullpen, which really helped. They didn't have to overuse guys, didn't have to tire anyone out, and they were able to sort of stretch out the rotation, which they didn't completely do in spring training. So far, so good. And while that might not last, you know, it's the same for with all these injuries, whether it's David Wright or Travis d'Arnaud or what they've got going on in the bullpen. The longer they go and the bigger cushion they build while these guys are on the disabled list, all of a sudden, the less they're going to miss them, you know, if things start going south, because the sooner it's going to be until they come back. So what they're doing now is just almost creating an insurance policy for themselves that they're cashing at the same time. And, you know, this is a team that, yeah, how are they doing it without all these guys? I really don't know. I don't have a good answer. I don't think a lot of people have a good answer, but they are doing it. And it's just been really, really tremendous to watch.
And there was a little bit of a scare this week about Matt Harvey, but everybody swears it's perfectly fine. There's nothing to worry about. Is that your read, that this really is perfectly fine and there's nothing to worry about?
Well, it's not an arm injury. It's an ankle injury. So that's, you know, the massive good thing for the Mets. He does have what the Mets are calling a mild sprained ankle. I like to take the mild out of everything the Mets say, because it tends – you know, these things can tend to linger, and a lot of things that have been labeled mild in the past have turned out to be anything but. But the fact that it is a leg thing and not an arm thing leads me to sort of be optimistic from a Mets perspective on this one, that you don't necessarily worry about it. Now, you know, if he starts against the Yankees and all of a sudden lands funny, you know, ankle injuries can tend to linger and can tend to get serious. So it's definitely something to watch. But as far as it stopping Matt Harvey from being who he is on the mound, I don't think it'll have any effect, at least in the short term, going forward.
All right. And now let's talk a little franchise four here. The Mets are one of those clubs with some that are very obvious, and maybe the last one is not so obvious. Tom Seaver, Mike Piazza, David Wright, Keith Hernandez are in. Gary Carter, John Franco, Doc Gooden, and Daryl Strawberry are out. If it were up to you, any of those guys who are currently out that you would bump up in favor of any of the guys who are currently in?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be really difficult to keep Doc Gooden out. I mean, he was such a franchise-changing person. He owned the city of New York for quite a few years. I mean, he was the Mets, and he really defined what that team, what that world champion 1986 team was all about. You know, he essentially single-handedly made the Mets relevant. I'd have a really tough time keeping him out, whether you want to put him in ahead of David Wright, who still, you know, has plenty left to accomplish, or ahead of Keith Hernandez, who had a lot of his best years elsewhere. I mean, I would argue for either one of those. But, yeah, for me, Doc Gooden has to be in there.
Well, I'll say it for you, since you have to deal with him semi-regular and I don't. I would put him in over Keith Hernandez, with no disrespect to him. I won't make you say it, since you got to face him.
I basically
said it. So I guess it's probably better for you than saying right.
I'm not sure Keith would argue.
Fine point. He had the best seat in the house for Doc. Todd, which is more real? The really strong starts by Odubel Herrera and Freddy Galvis, and I still want to pronounce that like Odubel McDowell instead of Odubel. That just shows my age. Those two guys off to really good starts, or the really slow starts by Ryan Howard and Chase Utley?
Oh boy, that is tough, because when you group those two guys, group those guys in pairs, because I tend to think that Odubel Herrera can be a pretty good hitter. Now, probably, you know, if he hits over 300 by the end of the year, nobody will be more surprised than me. But he does have the makings of a guy that could be a pretty good top of the order contact guy. You know, 275, 280, 285. He seems to be that type of guy, or have that type of potential. You know, Freddy Galvis is off to an unbelievable start, but I keep going back to his career numbers in the big leagues and his career numbers in the minor leagues, and those numbers are always around, you know, batting average between 220, 240, and OPS around the 630, 640, 650 mark. So I tend to think he's going to cool off. You know, they've talked a lot about working the philosophy of hitting and taking a shorter swing and those types of things. But, boy, you know, I guess I'm a guy that I have to see you do it first before I believe that you're actually there. And, you know, if Freddie Galvis can keep it up, that's great. But I just don't know if he can do it the entire season. Now, on the other hand, you have Utley. And I know this sounds like, you know, a lot of hitters say this, is like, well, he's really hit a lot of hard balls lately right at people. But Utley really has over the past several days. He's hit a lot of good line drive outs, a lot of hard ground ball outs that haven't gone through. So I tend to think that he is going to get things turned around. Certainly nobody in the organization seems overly worried about it. Now, Howard, on the other hand, I think there is some real concern there with his bat. You know, he hit a home run Tuesday night against the Marlins, his first of the season. So I think they're hoping that maybe that can get the ball rolling a little bit. But as we talked about last week on the podcast, he's getting a really steady diet of fastballs in the strike zone. And so far, he hasn't been able to really make much use of it. So to me, that's kind of a concerning issue going forward for him.
Looking elsewhere around this lineup, there are a couple other things that really jump out. What are they going to do with Grady Sizemore?
That's a great question, because Dominic Brown right now, they've really extended his rehab stint in AAA out. Pretty much sounds like they're going to give him the full 20 days, even though he doesn't need the full 20 days health-wise. I think what they're saying is that they just want to give him at bats. But when Dominic Brown comes back, which should be sometime next week, I think his 20th day on that rehab clock is April 28th. So he should be back late next week. When he does come back, you look around that roster and you say, all right, well, you can't really – you need some right-handed bats on the team. So you got to keep Darren Ruff around. You got to keep Jeff Francoeur around. You need more than one infielder. So Andres Blanco and Cesar Hernandez are probably going to stick around. And then you look at it and go, okay, Dominic Brown, young player that they still think might have some promise, hits left-handed, Grady Sizemore, older player, not really doing much of anything since last August. He hits left-handed. So you wonder if his spot on the roster – might be kind of coming down to the end. I mean, this is just my opinion. Like I said, when you look at the roster and you see kind of the pieces, you go, they're kind of the same player in some ways, and that they're just two left-handed outfielders, left-handed hitting outfielders, and do you really need two of them on the roster right now?
Even after scoring seven runs the other night, and again, just to keep looking around this offense, even after scoring seven runs in the last game, they're still last in the majors at under three runs per game. How does this get better? I understand it's a rebuilding year, but at some point, there's got to be – that can't be okay. How does this offense get to where it's at least adequate?
Yeah, that basically what they're going to have to hope for is a lot of these guys just get a little bit closer to the career averages. And I'm not saying that, you know, Ryan Howard's not going to get back to his career averages. Chase Utley's not going to be the hitter that he once was, you know, between 2005 and 2010, but at least be a little bit more productive. Same thing with Carlos Ruiz, Darren Ruff. I think they're certainly hoping that Cody Ashe, Odubel Herrera, Freddie Galvis can continue to hit. I think they're expecting more from Ben Revere. So really there's not much they can do, because here's the thing. They don't really have a guy waiting in the wings ready to come up and take somebody's job. Now, Michael Franco, their third base prospect, can play a little bit of first base. He's off to a great start in AAA, and I think he's going to be a guy that could get a good look at some point in the future. But I believe, as we've discussed before, maybe in a previous podcast or two, if he stays in the minor leagues until mid-May, late May, they could possibly get an extra year of team control under him. So instead of becoming a free agent after 2020, he could become a free agent after 2021. So right now there's almost zero incentive to call him up and give him a shot. So at some point, maybe after May, June, July, if Howard is still really struggling, then maybe you can bring up Michael Franco. But really, Matthew, other than that, there's not a lot of guys knocking at the door of this team. They have some guys in Double A that are off to pretty good starts. Roman Quinn, the center fielder, Aaron Altair, corner outfielder, that are off to really good starts. But again, the way the Phillies look at it is we don't want to rush these guys because we know we're not going to win this year. So let's kind of allow them to gain confidence, gain experience at the minor level, continue to bring them up at the proper pace. And hopefully when they do come up here, they're here and ready to succeed right away, then rather than calling them up too early out of desperation, and then you kind of set them back and you ruin their confidence, or you get their mechanics out of whack, or something else happens along those lines.
The recently read that there was Chad Billingsley missed a start. Doesn't sound like it's anything significant, but in a club looking for bright spots, he's been encouraging, and it's kind of a reason to be optimistic. Is he still heading in the right direction? Is he still getting closer to joining the Major League roster?
Yeah, I think so. He's probably got three more rehab starts to make. That's based off of what he said a week ago. He said he was going to make five rehab starts. He's made two to this point, so three more to go. Looks like he could join the rotation sometime in early May. And, yeah, that is a guy that they are optimistic about. They hope that he can come in and kind of solidify that number five spot in the rotation, which is currently being held by Sean O'Sullivan. And in the best case scenario, Chad Billingsley pitches great, looks like his old self, and at the trade deadline, a team looking for a starting pitcher goes, "Hey, wow, Chad Billingsley, he's only making $1.5 million this year, and he's a free agent after this season. Maybe we can get him from the Phillies, and maybe the Phillies can get a decent prospect in return." So I think certainly the Phillies are keeping their fingers crossed that something along those lines can actually take place.
All right. And now that we're wrapped up talking about this year's club for the time being, let's talk about the past. The Franchise 4 results came out, or the first round results at least. The top of the Phillies list is pretty obvious. Mike Schmidt and Steve Carlton would be pretty hard guys to ignore, as would Richie Ashburn. Chase Utley slots in at fourth with Jim Bunning, Chuck Klein, Robin Roberts, and Jimmy Rollins on the outside. Anything about that you would change if it were your vote? And I guess you could vote. Any of those guys on the outside that you would bump in over one of the four guys who are on that list?
You know, for me, it was very surprising that Jimmy Rollins is not in that top four, just because he set the franchise hits record last year. And he really has meant so much to this organization from 2000 until 2014. You know, he doesn't necessarily have, the overall, I guess, like the OPS type numbers to compare with Utley. But when you talk about influence on an organization, he was there from the very beginning. He was a guy that not only played an all-star caliber shortstop, won some gold gloves, won the MVP in 2007, hit at the top of the lineup, hit for power at the top of the lineup. But he also was a very influential member in this clubhouse. You remember before the 2007 season, he said, "Yeah, I think we're the team to beat. I know we finished 14 games behind the Mets a year earlier, but I think we're the team to beat." And he really backed up those words, and I think he created a little bit of swagger in that Phillies clubhouse. So I guess I'm surprised that he's not somewhere in that top four. Utley obviously is a fan favorite, and if he didn't have injuries kind of derail his career for a few years there, that's a guy also that could be headed to the Hall of Fame someday. But I would think Rollins would be in there. Certainly Mike Schmidt is a no-brainer. Steve Carlton is one of the greatest left-handers in baseball history. Richie Ashburn not only was a great player in the 50s, but he was a revered broadcaster, so I'm sure that has something to do with it as well. But honestly, I wouldn't have a problem if it was Schmidt, Carlton, Rollins, and Utley. To me, that makes a lot of sense. Although again, you can make an argument for Chase, and you can make an argument for Richie Ashburn as well.
This is MLB.com Extras. Thanks everybody for listening.